Okay, let's get started here. Welcome. First off, thank you all very much for coming out to this very special presentation on the Jewish communities of Medellin, Colombia. For those who heard bits and pieces of this before, apologize, deal with the repetition. Between May 25th and May 27th, I was sent out to, let me just check to make sure, yeah, that's all recording fine. I was sent out to this community of Medellin, initially by Rabbi Mark Angel of the Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue and Rabbi Alfredo Goldschmidt, who's the rabbi in Bogota, for all intents and purposes, the chief rabbi of Colombia. There were two purposes to this trip. One was to assist in the conversion of 11 Jews in the town of Medellin, and the second was to investigate the community of Beja, both of which I'll explain at length over the course of this presentation. But first I have to acknowledge and thank again Rabbis Angel and Rabbi Goldschmidt for giving me the opportunity to go on this trip. And you'll see the point of this is in a sense a little bit twofold. One is to show, well, here's how another Jewish community lives, because it's on one hand interesting to see certain differences. On the other hand, as we'll see towards the end, there are a lot of things that are the same, at least in patterns about how religious communities develop and interact with each other. Just a couple of things to keep in mind. So let's get started. On the first slide here, let me see, where exactly is this place Medellin in relationship to Colombia? We're on slide two here. So you see, this is Panama, really like the south of Central America. Medellin is in northern part of South America, where Bogota is down here. And you can kind of see the borderlines here about just where Colombia is and where this Medellin is in relation to Colombia. Not too much up on South American geography, so this will have to do. What is Medellin? When we talk about Medellin, it really refers to two different things. One is a metropolitan area, and the other is the specific city. I put the analogy here is, when you refer to New York, right? New York is an entity like New York City, right? We think of, the five boroughs, but you think of New York, you're really talking about Manhattan, because, we're just Manhattanites and we think that way. So here, in a way, the term Medellin goes both ways. It refers to the entire metropolitan area and to the specific community. I'll try to make a distinction if I ever get, if I'm ever unclear, please correct me and I will specify. And in terms of socioeconomic status, you have more of the wealth in this area and it gets slightly less affluent as you go further north in the metropolitan area. So where are the Jews that we're talking about? So the two communities, you have Medellin and you have up here further north in the less affluent community of Beja. Medellin is more affluent, well-established, about 90 years old based on what I heard, and Beja is relatively new because they just recently converted. I should point out that most of the information I'm getting here, I got from people who live there. I cannot vouch entirely for the accuracy as, anything you get when, people are volunteering information, but I'm assuming that everything here is going to be accurate. So the Jews of Medellin, so now we're talking about the very specific community of the metropolitan area. So they've been around for at least 90 years. They are wealthy compared to the rest of Colombia. I put in here income bracket 5 to 6 out of 6. In American economics, we're happy to be sensitive to, we call them tax brackets. And, we've got little quintiles based on how much money you make of, are you in the 0 to 20%, 20 to 40%. So they have a similar system. Out of 5, kind of 6 for the people who are above 5. So you're really talking here about, the upper class of, Colombia, really. Most of them are self-employed in the sense that they own their own businesses. If you own your own business, odds are you're a factory owner, or in some cases here, they're importers. There are several Israelis that, oddly enough, have a mixed reputation from what I've been told in Colombia. As one person put it, there's a sense amongst, when I say mixed reputation, I mean amongst Colombians, not the Jewish community, as people who go to Colombia either for drugs or other illicit things in the country. It has caused a bit of concern because you know, we'll talk a bit about this a little bit later, when you don't have too many Jews around, every little detail about a Jewish community can get blown out of proportion of, oh, this is what Jews are. So if they see, you know, Israelis come in and an identification with Israeli and Jewish buying drugs, it's not too much of a jump to say, well, Jews are into drugs. So there's a bit of a mixed reputation there. It's not that as bad as that might have sound, but it's important to know that. The actual town has had several rabbis over the years, including a conservative rabbi. The current rabbi there now, very fine person. He's studying at Ner Yisrael in Baltimore. And he's really been doing a lot for the community at this point. The previous conservative rabbi we'll talk about, you know, maybe a little bit later when we get to the conversion side. Fascinating thing that in South America, you have very strong conservative Jewish bases in Argentina and Costa Rica. And they seem to have a lot more almost gravitas in South America that you might say that they do even in North America, just based on the religious dynamics that they have. We're going to see in a second now, in terms of the first thing, the infrastructure of the Jewish community of Colombia, this is, or at least of Medellin. First is the private school called Colegio Theodor Herzl. Tuition is about $800 a month, which, you know, compared to our yeshiva education is almost laughable. There, you could probably imagine it's significantly, you know, more expensive compared to the regular income. They teach Zionism, Jewish holidays, Hebrew, like most things that you'd find in a Jewish school in America. The clincher, though, is out of 250 students, only 30 of them are actually Jewish. The reason being, it still is a superior education than the alternatives. So you wind up having a lot of students there who are not Jewish, who are being trained Jewishly and raised Jewishly, raised with a love of Israel, love of Zionism, you know, knowledge of Hebrew and knowledge of Jewish holidays, despite the fact that they're not really Jewish. And I don't know if they'll have any intention of being in the future. On slide 7 here, you see that this is, you know, one of their, you know, many banners that they have. You know, nice little Zionist iconography there. This is a shot here on slide 8. Over here on the left-hand side, you see some of the students. This is their Beit Knesset, the place where they daven. You see it's pretty much like a normal school. Here on slide 9, you can get a sense that it is a very open type of school. Here on this bottom left-hand corner, this is a shot from the car. You see that they don't really have like walls like you normally have in a very large building, right? You have, it's almost like a motel. You have this outside open area and the classrooms, you know, go in and out. One of the reasons why they can do that is the climate in Medellin is incredibly temperate. It's about 70 degrees all year round. When I was there, it happened to rain a little bit more. And they take full advantage of it. Down here, you kind of see their gym, which is an open air gym. I put this picture here on the bottom right, and we'll see a little bit of this in another shot, that they do a great deal of transliterations, and we'll see that the Jewish communities both use a transliterated chumash based on the Latin American Spanish pronunciation. So their J is the closest analogy to our ch sound. So their Pesach is actually spelled P-E-S-A-J, and I just found that very amusing. So yes, even though the Jewish community in Colombia might be relative, or at least in Medellin, you know, may be relatively small, they still managed to build, you know, their own Jewish private school, and managed to get funded with, you know, with a lot of non-Jewish, you know, students there too. This is the synagogue in Medellin on slide 10 here. See a little bit more on the inside. You know, this looks like, from the inside, pretty much like any synagogue you'll find elsewhere. You know, normal, traditional-looking Aron Kodesh, balcony, although that's not really, it's only used in the high holidays. Down here is where the women normally sit on, like, the that side of the plants. You find here, I want to talk a little bit about the artwork. This table, these windows and a lot of the other artwork and woodworking in the synagogue were actually made by a member of the synagogue itself. And that's a theme you're going to find, that the people who are artistically inclined are going to volunteer their talents for the synagogue. One, because they can, and you know, two, it's also much better for the synagogue. Here you'll notice that this window is perpetually open. Part of, you know, Columbia, or at least Marijin, because the weather is so, you know, so nice, they can just use a lot more of the natural air in their buildings. Now here, I want to talk about a couple of interesting things. Right up here, this upper left-hand corner, is the mikvah. They in fact have a mikvah in the shul itself, which you can imagine is important. We'll see in a later slide, why I keep, you know, pushing things off to later, we'll see, like, what does it mean not to have a mikvah building, you know, designated in Columbia. Here, when they built it, they managed to put in the mikvah. Over here is one of the spreads that they have for a regular daily kiddush. Over here on the side, I put in one of the, instead of, like, showing things about the social hall, this is a wedding that we did. After the, sorry about that, that little pop-up thing here. Wait till that goes away. There we go. Sorry, let me shut this off so we won't have that up again. Okay. Oops. Sorry. They had an upstairs hall which also doubled as a wedding hall. Because you could imagine, Marijin does not have Jewish wedding halls. So when they get married, it's actually in the upstairs area of the synagogue. And it was a really fascinating wedding that we spoke a bit about, you know, this past Shabbat. You know, a lot more lower key, but, you know, fine wedding nonetheless. It's important to realize that your least major distinction that you'll have from the community of Marijin, you know, compared to the community of Bejo, is that because it is and has been a fairly affluent community, they were able to afford to do all this stuff, right? It, you know, sounds kind of obvious. When you have money, you can build things. You can build a school, even though there are only, you know, 30 Jewish kids. You can build a shul, and a really nice shul, and keep it, you know, well maintained when you have the financial support to do so. In contrast, we have the community of Bejo, even though it's spelled B-E-L-L-O, it's pronounced Bejo. There's a population of 350 to 400,000, depending on what stats you read. The income level is 2 to 3 out of 6. So we're talking here about middle class or lower middle class, again, depending on, you know, what side that you're reading. It is a primarily Catholic an evangelical Christian neighborhood. I threw an evangelical Christian. It's a little bit hard for me to distinguish someone. Predominantly, Columbia is a Catholic country, or at least Marijin is a Catholic city. From what I picked up from various words that people threw out, there seemed to have been an evangelical strain there as well. In terms of the Jewish community, here's the grand story, or at least the best version that I got. You had a group of 300, it's funny here, I put in 300 Jews. Really, it should be 300 people left the Catholic community of 3,000. Possibly, they went, before they found Judaism, went to evangelical Christianity. In the meantime, I wasn't entirely sure about that. What is sure is that they had a love of Israel from the Christian tradition. In fact, there's a YouTube video of the leader of the community singing one of the Adon Olam's that, you know, Safam and a few others, you know, Adon Olam, Hashem Olam, you know, this is even before they even thought about becoming Jewish, that there was a celebration of Israel in Bejo, Colombia, which sounds, I would think, pretty strange, considering that, you know, before this point, there weren't actually any Jews in Bejo, Colombia at all. This last line here, fourth point here, of a possible crypto-Jewish heritage. I say possible here because, well, it wasn't, when I went down there, the way it was described to me was that the community itself were B'nai Anusim, which means that they were descendants of Muranos, effectively, or from, you know, the Spanish expulsion. You had communities that spread out all over the place, and some maintained what is called in academia today a crypto-Jewish tradition. And there are pockets of crypto-Jews, you know, in Mexico and further south in Latin America. I say possible here because they weren't entirely sure. There seem to have been strains of Jewish practices, or at least practices consistent with crypto-Judaism. One in particular, someone volunteered, was that before they entered the house, they would wash their hands. And in one of the books that I read, described that practice as sort of being a substitute for mikvah. I don't know. It doesn't seem to be that they thought that they were actually Jewish, but because there seemed to have been this theory of, well, we have this as part of our heritage, it kind of gave them an affinity for being Jewish. When you find in Jewish literature discussing B'nai Anusim, it's more, are they Jewish or are they not Jewish? Do you assume that they are? Do you assume that they're not? Here they don't assume that they are, and they rather assume that we need to convert. And what happened was 30 people converted with a rabbi in Miami, who after he converted 30 of these 300, kind of dropped them, and you know they're kind of in limbo at this point. One of the questions that I did ask was, you know, fine, very nice, you might have had this tradition. What in the world possessed you to go to Judaism? And the initial impetus, as far as I got, was the lay leader of the community went to Israel, because, again, they had a very strong love of Israel, and found a Chilean Jew and had a discussion about religion, and that apparently was enough of a spark to get him to come back and start the discussion about, you know, learning more about Judaism and effectively all converting. Now, why choose Judaism? Right, okay, I forgot to put this here. So the community leader, right, found this Chilean person on slide 15, if anyone's following, mentioned about the possible history of Marranos. They're passionately following the Sephardi tradition, which they learned through imitation. Now you think about, how is a Jewish community in Colombia going to know what does it mean to be Jewish? And one of the ways that they've managed to, you know, to set things up is the leaders of the community went to Sephardi shuls in Miami and said, well, this is what you do. This is what it means to be Jewish. We're going to do this too. We'll see some examples of this. So first off, in terms of following the Sephardi tradition, the acting rabbi there now follows Yalkut Yosef. For those unfamiliar, Yalkut Yosef is a collection of laws and teachings by Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, considered to be the leading Sephardi authority today. There is an incredibly strong commitment to Shabbat, Kashrut, Taharat HaMishpacha, family purity, and continuing education for themselves and their children, such that they have a strong desire just to be Jewish, determine what Jews, or at least in their tradition, Sephardi Jews do, and do that. I'll describe it a bit. You know, I mentioned in synagogue here a couple of times, their passion is very difficult for me to describe without actually showing what it is that they go through, and what have they gone through, and what they've been able to build in a relatively short time. When we get to the pictures, you should know that most of this happened within the past 5 years or so. And it is really incredible. I can't necessarily convey the passion with which they describe their commitment to these laws, but we'll see a little bit in advance as we advance. So here on slide 17, you see this is the synagogue. The synagogue space right now is rented, and they have it for a couple of years. The people in the community are predominantly renting near the synagogue until they actually have a permanent spot, so that they can actually buy a spot within walking distance of the synagogue. From the surface, this looks like any normal synagogue. Now, right, people with talit, tefillin, most of their religious items they've gotten from America or imported through some, you know, weird connections. That is not a, is regular, no, that's a regular light. Just happens to be a much brighter thing. Yeah, I do need a new camera, so I apologize if the details are out. You'll notice here, like, the bima and the shtenders here, most of the woodworking, like you found in Marijin, were done by artisans in the community themselves. You know, because, you know, they said, well, we need it. They certainly can't afford to buy it or have it imported, and yet they were able to do it internally. Here, there's Sidur. I thought this might come up a little bit better on a screen. This is Ashrei. Here you have a transliteration of Ashrei, and here you have the English one. Nice little model of the Mikdash. Their library is basically whatever they can get, whatever they can get donated in particular. So they have a great deal of English books up here, and even though, you know, I'm not sure how many of them actually read English, but a lot of books are in English. Oddly enough, they have a version of The Midrash Says in Spanish, which I thought was kind of interesting. Now, I included these two pictures here on slide 19 for two reasons. One, this is inside the Aron. And as you can tell, you know, they have the basic essentials of what you would expect a Jewish community, a traditional Jewish community, to have. They have a Sefer Torah. There was some story behind the Sefer Torah I didn't fully get. These are Megillot here. You have your shofar. I included this little picture here on the right-hand side. You might have seen this picture before in other synagogues, right? Does anyone, you know, looks a little bit familiar? Now, this community in Bezo, right, considering that they're completely new to Judaism, I'm guessing have no idea what this means. I'm guessing they don't know where it comes from. Why do they have it? Because when they go to another synagogue or a Sephardi synagogue and they see something like this hanging, think, oh, this is what a Sephardi synagogue has, so this is what we're going to have as well. On the upstairs level, this little spot here on slide 20 on the left-hand side looks like an ordinary, you know, dining room, a place where people sit and eat. Every Friday night, the entire community comes together and eats. They typically bring their food before Shabbat. This is a storeroom on the side. There's a little bed here in case anybody needs to sleep for a bit. But one of the ways they keep Shabbat, to show their passion about having a full Shabbat in Kehillah, is that they all have it together. They bring all their food beforehand. They have their meals here. Some people will stick around until, there are some people who have like a little far walk. Some people will stay here a full day on Shabbat just so that they can daven and be with the entire Jewish community. And let me go back a slide or two, which might not have come across so well. Here, if you go back to page 17, I'm not sure if I can really convey here just how many people are at this minyan. I was there for a day, and in this community of, you know, again, 20 to 35 Jews, or 30 Jews, we had about 25 to 30 men and 25 to 30 women for Shacharit and for Mincha, which is something that you don't really find amongst any Jewish community in America, because you're talking about the exact same people who will come back. Also, I'm not sure if it comes out from the picture, but about 80% of the women covered their hair, which I thought also fascinating in terms of, you know, what things, when you're coming from scratch and you're only like picking up certain things from Judaism, what are the ones that you're going to pick up and adopt? And it seemed that they were picking up things that might be considered, you know, if not major and important, certainly minimizing what we might consider like completely superfluous. Over here, they have a day school. The woman in the middle here on slide 21 is the wife of the rabbi. And within a span of a few short years, they put together a day school. And you see a little bit here about what it is that they're doing. This woman all the way on the left here is a certain teacher's aide who's also necessary for them to be fully accredited for the, by the municipality. And these are the types of things that they will actually make. And there was a whole slew of things of, you know, creative activities that they, that they've done with the children. And again, it's because they have such a strong desire to educate their children in terms of what does it mean to raise a Jewish life, and they consider that a priority. I mentioned kashrut, right? One of the members of the community opened this little kosher market, not sure if it's really readable on the slide here, right across the street from the shul. Down here, they import kosher meat, which is pretty rare for them in Colombia, in Bejo. The meat is shafted from in Bogota and brought over. They set up a little cafe here, and this is, you know, anything on the shelves here are either under specific supervision or it's in their kashrut book. If anyone is familiar with England, the kashrut in England isn't just, you know, not everything has a stamp on the actual package like they do in America, but there's a book where you know what products are kosher and what, or at least what are, you know, are kosher. Similar thing in Colombia. Certain things have a certification on it. Other things, you have a book that you rely on. But in order to facilitate having kosher food, one of the members of the community just set up a kosher market in Bejo, Colombia, again, from scratch. The shelves, you know, might seem a little sparse now. I don't know how they stock it. And they also set up a little cafe here for, like, socialization, say, after Shabbat. You want to go over, have some kosher food, and watch a soccer game with the friends in your community, go right ahead. Yeah, and now here's where, you know, I mentioned about the mikvah. To really get a sense of the dedication, you have to know what they go through to kill the mikvah. Here, on slide 23, is the road that they drive up to. This is on a property of a non-Jewish fellow who lives already about a 30 to 40 minute drive outside of Bejo, Colombia. When you park, you walk up this little path, here on the right-hand side of slide 23. You have to go past this fence. I mean, this was really stunning to me, so I took a few pictures of the actual walk of what does it take to get to your mikvah. And this is it, on slide 26 here. This is their mikvah. This is where the women go every single month. And this is what they have to, just drive to and make that walk to go into this water. On one end, it looks like a very, nice natural spring. But you could probably imagine how cold it would be at 6:30 in the morning, especially if there's a light rain. And they do this on a regular basis for no other reason than they are that passionate about what does it mean to live and to be Jewish. And to me, I thought, this was something I found, personally very powerful. Because in America, you hear a lot of complaints about a mikvah like this and mikvahs like that. I don't know, how much it actually discourages people from going. But when you actually have that strong desire and passion to keep mitzvot and to keep things correctly and keep things properly, there's a great deal you can put up with. So what exactly did the Jewish community in Bejo want? So one is they want money, or at least, they would like money for infrastructure. They'd like a full-fledged synagogue. They'd like a mikvah indoors, preferably heated, so that they don't have to go through all those things. They want a guiding rabbi for conversions and continuing education. I want to explain about this a little. The previous rabbi, I mentioned, had dropped them. Previously, the way that they handled their education were things, either books that they brought in. There was a great deal done off the internet where they would hold like a Skype conference and people would come in and the rabbi would speak to them over the internet, with a video camera. Right now, I think they still may do that once a week, but, there are regular classes that are all regularly attended. They want recognition as a legitimate community. National and international are subject to politics. I'll explain that in a second. And this bottom line here that I got from the leader that very much impressed me was, even if the above criteria are not met, they're still going to continue doing what they're doing. And that I found just very inspirational, probably the best thing to say. It's, we want to be Jewish. We are going to live a Jewish life. We're going to live a committed Jewish life. And we'd like your help. We could use your help. But if we don't get your help, we're still going to do this anyway. Let me see if I explained here. Now, the Colombian Jewish politics, surprised that they exist. So here are a couple of things here. I mentioned about the strong conservative presence in South America. This was one of the impetus for reconversions, despite controversies. What does that mean? The previous rabbi, or one of the earlier rabbis, was a conservative rabbi, and either him or one of the people who were on the overseeing court did not keep Shabbat, like publicly, like would carry on Shabbat itself, without thinking anything of it. Regardless of one thinks of conservative Judaism, if someone does not keep Shabbat, it would disqualify them from serving as a member of the Beit Din, as a member of the court for the actual conversions. So because of that, the new rabbi said, well, whoever converted under, under this person would need to undergo what is called a Giyur L'Chumra, a conversion for stringency, which for the most part is just going into the mikvah once again. Having the mikvah wasn't a big issue because it's already there. One of the reasons why I flew down was to be, an additional rabbi in the process. Problem, though, is that the conservative movement is not only strong, but there's a certain degree of professional courtesy involved there, too. And they were incredibly annoyed that the Orthodox rabbi was reconverting people, the implication being that he didn't think that their conversions were good, which, of course, was a true assumption, but they really didn't like that, to the point where the conservative authority called up the people who previously converted conservative to try to convince them not to reconvert. They were unsuccessful in many cases. They were successful in a couple. We ran into one after we did the whole slew of conversions. So that's one area of religious controversies, which kind of pales in comparison, I think, to Orthodox conservative controversies today in America, whereas today, we're kind of split for all intents and purposes, and one side isn't really affected by what the other one does. Here they are, and I didn't spend enough time with the conservative Jews to really know what's going on there, but know that it's there. Now, I mentioned that one of the things that the Bejo community is looking for internal acceptance. And I shouldn't say Medellin or Colombia, I should have said Bogota. They're not really accepted. Particularly the Jews in Medellin and Bogota look very negatively upon the Jews of Bejo. Why? So from what I heard, the first one were issues of social status and income level. Right? The Jews in Medellin, they said, were in the upper tax brackets, 5-6, really the affluent, and the Jews of Bejo were not. That affects public perceptions. By public perceptions, I mean, and I think if you are the only Jews in the neighborhood, or really in the city, not too many in the country, then your neighbors are going to assume every characteristic that you have is indicative of Judaism. Which means, if the only Jews that you know are all incredibly wealthy, then it's not a stretch to say Jews are wealthy, almost by definition. When you see, well, hey, they're Jewish too, but they're poor, then that kind of changes the whole dynamic about how Jews are viewed in society at large. That seems to be a motivating factor from, at least, and these are from people that I got of, why would they not accept them? I would also suggest that there's possibly a sense of religious insecurity as well, that such that, the communities in Medellin, for as much as they built up, did not see that they had the same religious passion or fervor that you had in Bejo. It would be a difference between, the bourgeois versus, a lower class type of religion where you'll find much more passion and people who are much more into it and will take it more seriously as the ones, who can, show up whenever they want, take it, a little bit more casually. And I think that there might be a factor of that too. And you see that sometimes in America between religious and non-religious Jews, where they say, that person, keeps Shabbat, that person needs to leave by a certain time on Friday, don't you need to do that? And it sort of like brings up that, well, maybe you're not doing everything or at least as much as someone else. Especially in these last two areas, I think that you really do have parallels in America in terms of why, where one Jewish community might not be as accepted by another Jewish community. I mean, we do definitely have our slew of other issues in America, but I do think that these are patterns that you will find in other Jewish communities too, of a wealthy community might reject the authenticity or sincerity of a newer community. In terms of action, and you would think that normally in matters of Jewish law, you would just see, well, what are they doing? Are they keeping kosher? Are they doing everything fine? And then accept them based on the merits. But because especially of the social status issue, there's an assumption, or at least in rhetoric, that the reason why the Jews in Bejo converted is because they wanted to improve their social standing. And it's a lot easier to say, convert to Judaism than it is to earn a lot more money. So, obviously, they're doing it to improve their social status. And it got to the point where certain rabbis are not even allowed to visit the communities because their own congregations want nothing to do with them or even to give them a shred of legitimacy, which I personally don't think is typically fair, especially because, we saw a bit of what the Jewish community in Bejo was able to do in a really short span of time. I should also add, in terms of what their lifestyle is like. I took out a lot of pictures, with people because I didn't want to, publicize people, on the internet or not without their permission. But one family I met, the husband actually chose a profession, went to become a factory owner so he could be his own boss. If you're your own boss, you can control keeping Shabbat a lot better than you otherwise would have. The people in Bejo are really trying to live and structure their entire lives around being Jewish, possibly because it's lower income, possibly because of the nature of how they broke off, but it's really a tight-knit family of 300 people who are kind of all in this together. So when they do stuff, it's really more of a built-in kihilah, which is not something you find too often. Sometimes when most people convert to Judaism, they go as individuals. Here you have a really tight-knit community in kihilah that really wants to go through this entire process together. And if anyone wants, I actually have a couple of the flyers that they've tried to make for PR purposes to help drum up support. I mentioned in terms of one of the things they wanted was the international recognition. International recognition such that they can actually receive some form of assistance of like, yes, this is a real Jewish community. And not to have the assumption of, well, they're just new, they're 5 years, they don't really know what they're doing. Truth be told, this is one of the most serious communities I have ever seen and ever encountered. And, you know, based on their passion and dedication and just what they've been able to do, I mean, both in a short span of time, like to get a shul, to have a shul look as normal as it does, to have kosher food, and also do this on really a shoestring budget without having the resources of, say, you know, the people in Marijin who might be more affluent, they're still, you know, middle and lower middle class people who just have such a strong desire to put this together, I certainly think would be a worthy endeavor. But this is, you know, that's one of the things I have to speak to Rabbi Angel about in terms of, you know, next steps for it. All right, so that's really, you know, the essence of the, you know, basic presentation. Open to any questions that people may have on any of anything related. Yes?
What about what's their attitude towards taking China's silverware, stemware, and making them kosher with mikvah?
Oh, well, there are two things. One is toveling dishes, and the other would be koshering. Ostensibly, I didn't ask about that. I would assume that they would use this place if they would need to tovel dishes. This would be their mikvah. And they would have to schlep all the way out there for that.
Do they do it? I mean, you know, they're not necessarily,
I don't know.
Kosher.
So,
kosher is, you know,
it's hard. Mm-hmm. Well, koshering and the toveling are two separate things. As far as all the detailed practices that they do, I honestly don't know. I was in Colombia for all of 3 days. The first day was there just me getting in, settling in. I spent 1 day in Bejo and 1 day in Marijin with the conversions. So I had, like, everything I got, like, really had to be accelerated. What I can say is this. Whatever they've been taught, they do. If they don't do it, I don't think it's because they reject it. I just think they just don't know it enough yet. But if someone said, this is what you have to do, I have complete confidence that they would change their practice and do it.
What about the Lubavitch movement? I know they have outreach programs all over the world. Are they involved in Colombia?
So, it's funny you mention that. Yeah. Not that I've seen. The rabbi there, I don't know if he is affiliated with Chabad or not. I forgot to include the picture. I thought of doing it because I thought it was cute. There isn't a Chabad that I've seen there. There is, however, a Kabbalah center. And Berg is actually going to be down there at some point. But it was kind of funny that of all places, you know, in Medellin, Colombia, there's a Kabbalah center. But now, even if there would be a Chabad, Chabad doesn't really work in proselytizing, as far as I know, like making non-Jews Jews. They work in doing Jewish outreach, in terms of, you know, if you are Jewish. So I don't know if they have any plans to come down to, you know, Medellin, Colombia. You know, maybe. But certainly for Bejo, I'm not sure if they would head down there at this point now either. And I'm not sure if it would really work because, you know, the community is so entrenched in the Sephardi mindset of halacha. I'm not sure if that would be compatible if a Lubavitcher would come down. They would say, well, this isn't Sephardi. We're not going to do this. This is what we accepted to do. Any other questions, comments? Any thoughts? Okay. Yeah, so, you know, in the whole, I just, you know, I can't use the term fascinating enough, but I was definitely personally inspired by the Jewish community of Bejo because it really, you know, showed just what does it mean to have, like, a Jewish heart and to really approach it with a type of passion and dedication that you don't really see in America. You know, in some ways it's almost too easy here. In some ways, you know, there are just so many other people around that you can rely on that, you know, you wind up getting a little bit soft. I guess an advantage that they do have in Bejo is that because they are isolated, they don't have to face with a lot of other, you know, political stupidity that we have to deal with here in terms of, you know, either other, you know, not just neighboring communities, but in terms of, like, different religiosity, are you this type of Jew, that type of Jew, or have to deal with any of that. Like, they just really know, here's what we want to do, here's what we're going to do, and just kind of set out and do it. Yeah.
The community that doesn't accept that.
Yeah.
Is that basically Sephardi or
they seem to be. They seem to be mixed. The community in Bogota has both an Ashkenazi and Sephardi population. I don't know too much about them because I wasn't there. In Medellin, it seemed to be a little bit more Sephardi, but there were a couple of Ashkenazim there. And in fact, there are a bunch of American expatriates there. It's a kind of funny place, Medellin. Of the Americans that I met there, many of them just came on business, loved the place so much because it's got great weather. You don't need to earn that much, or at least in dollars, to really have a great life there. And it's just a very comfortable place to live. So you had Americans that just popped in and say, wow, this place is awesome. I'm just going to stay. And then they just kind of go with the flow there. I think if I recall correctly, the actual synagogue davened a form of Nesach Sfar. But there's a mixture of Ashkenazim who are there too. For the most part, no. Although, well, no. I wouldn't know. I would say for the most part, no, because you did have a base of the Jewish community there. When I talk about converts, I mean, from 90 years past, there was a Jewish community. There are quite a few converts in Medellin. I was there to help convert, 11 of them. And they have been, accepting of converts in many ways to help the Jewish community there. And I didn't get the full details in terms of standards, but in some ways, their standards for conversion might be considered more lenient, not just by American standards, but even by the standards of the people of Beja, in terms of, not just religious observance before conversion, but expected religious observance afterwards, which is kind of funny. Because, the people in Beja, they won't accept, but they'd be more accepting of the people in their own community, not based on religious observance levels, but based on other social things. One of the people there actually said that, if it wasn't for the conversions, they might have had to die out. Now, I don't know if that means that they're actively proselytizing versus they're just not making it difficult to convert, or they're just going to be a lot more open and a lot more welcoming to converts that you might find in other areas. For them, they could view it as, well, it's a little bit more of a matter of necessity for the people here. Whereas, in America, one reason why, we can be a little bit more, I don't know how to put this tactfully, selective, I guess is the best word that's coming to mind in terms of converting and making the process a little more difficult, is that, Jewish life can survive without converts. Probably wouldn't survive that much if they took a very hard line on who would be accepted into the community. I don't know percentage-wise of the community of Medellin how many people are converts. Hard to tell. Yeah.
The community you visited, is it considered Orthodox, or is it considered conservative?
They would consider themselves Orthodox in terms of definitions about, it's hard to even the social distinctions are, I can say this, the synagogue has separate seating. There's a mikveh that people go to. They try to make kosher food available. They have a Jewish school. In terms of how much do people actually keep on the whole, I wasn't there long enough to tell. And, I don't know how much you want to go by the semantic, change of what does it mean to affiliate Orthodox versus to practically be observant. As we know, there are quite a few shuls that are Orthodox synagogues, but not everyone who comes might be fully observant. Happens a couple of places. I couldn't really get that sense, from the one day that I was there. Yeah?
When you use the term Sephardi, do you mean it in the strict sense, the Judaic or the Latino speakers, or do you mean
Sephardi as well? Thank you for bringing that up. It seemed, I don't know the name of the original rabbi that they had. It almost seems to be a little bit of a combination, in the sense that, when they follow Yalkut Yosef, that seems to be more of the Edot Mizrach, type of halacha. But they, have brought in a lot of stuff in Spanish. So almost de facto, they're going to have, some of the Spanish traditions just based on the books that they've picked up, which, were translated. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean the community, mm-hmm. not the converts, but the other community.
Yeah, it would seem to be a little bit more of Edot Mizrach if you would pick one, it would be closer to that than, the Ladino community.
Right. And
That's my sense. Again, I was only there for a day.
Unless you can pull the Moroccan church, actually they split to three groups, but if they're adhering to, they don't accept conversion.
Right. Well, I mentioned that, you know, I was discussing, you know, their situation in the community of Asia. Like, you do have communities like that in America, you know, like the Syrians that don't accept converts for various reasons. Like, you know, well, I don't want to get into, you know, their communities. I don't think that they're the same reasons here. Or at least if they are, they'd be very dishonest. Because if you're going to say that, you know, somehow the Jews of Beja are going to water down religious life in Marijin, you can only say that if you never met them, or if you don't value Jewish life. Or at least you don't think that what they're doing is valuable. You know, because they're modern, they're very few even what we consider modern Orthodox communities that are, you know, observant as they are, at least as passionate about it. And I would say even among the Haredi communities, they, the Kamir and Bejo have one step over them because they are focused and they direct their passions to things that we would consider be the most important things about Judaism as opposed to the silliness that we've developed over time. Right? The fact that, you know, when you change jobs just so that you can keep Shabbat, when you set up your own kosher marketplace so that people can eat kosher, and this is where you're putting your energies in, you know, and the other thing is you want to impart everything that you know and love about Judaism to your kids, and that's one of your top four things, you know, it really means that your priorities are really in order. And, you know, it's not just that you have a passion for it, but it's, you know, really directed in the right way. Any other thoughts?
Is there a sitter same as what we say,
For the most part, yes. They use a lot of the transliterations, you know, for the people who don't yet know how to speak Hebrew. Let me try to load that back up. But for the most part, when I looked at it, it looked pretty much, you know, like any sitter you find. I did not notice major changes there. I don't remember if it was Nusach Sfard or Edot Mizrach offhand. I think it might have even been Nusach Sfard. They would have copied again whatever they would have seen in the Jewish communities, in the Sephardi Jewish communities in Miami, would be what they adopted. Yeah, you can't really make it out from here. But I thought that the transliteration was just very cool because, you know, they're doing it in the Latin American style. Anything else? Any academics? I don't think so. I don't know of anyone who's actually went down to study them, aside from myself. Again, the rabbis actually in Colombia, or at least the Orthodox rabbis, are kind of precluded from their own communities who want nothing to do with them, like don't even check them out. And as far as academics go, I don't know if academics would even know this place existed. I mean, let's think about it. Unless someone tells you about it, how are you going to find this out? Could it be open for academic study? You know, fine. They seem to be open and welcoming. I mean, I'd like to help them out first as opposed to, like, sending more people down to, like, you know, check them out as guinea pigs of, like, oh, let's see how you're developing here. But, look, if there's a sociologist out there who wants to do something on it, you know, I'm sure he could, you know, make some arrangements to head on out there. I stayed at a hotel in Marijin. Yeah.
So put that in touch with Mark Angel, or how did he get...
Probably Rabbi Alfredo Goldschmidt, who's the rabbi in Bogota. I had first met him at the International Rabbinic Fellowship Conference last year, so that's how I first met him. And I'm not privy to all of the conversations that went on in the back, but all I know is I got this email that asked if I want to go down. I said, well, sure. And I'm, you know, really happy that I didn't, you know, had this opportunity to just really see some amazing people. I should point out that the, you know, Rabbi of Marijin is, you know, only about 22, and he's, like, really responsible for a great deal of what goes on there, that's in the bigger city. So in terms of, like, rounding people up and really being the only teacher. And you have to be a pretty impressive person, you know, to be able to take on that much at that young of an age. Yeah.
Who supports him? I mean, does the community support the rabbi and give him a salary?
So in Marijin, yes, which is easier for them to do because, again, they're more affluent. In Beja, yes, just not as much because, you know, they don't have the money for it. The current acting rabbi in Beja, oddly enough, was at one point a previous rabbi in Marijin. And then he left, if I recall correctly, to go up to Panama, and then came back down to Beja. He himself does not live in the town of Beja. He lives outside, but they have an apartment in Bezhou for Shabbat where they stay. The apartments in Bezhou actually reminded me of Israel, you know, like small apartments, but, you know, tastefully done and whatnot. But from what I got, he does not get paid all that much from, you know, the Kila, because he just can't afford to. One of the reasons, I guess, why they want to raise money, and also why they started the day school, you know, so his wife can bring in some extra. But, you know, they're really doing a lot with, despite not having a lot. Yeah.
As an American, do you have to watch your consumption of water?
No. The city, let's put it this way. I didn't. Whether or not I should have is something else. But truth be told, Medellin had a very bad reputation because that's where Pablo Escobar was, you know, camped out for many years. And after, you know, he was killed, the drug trade moved to a place in the southwest called Cali and is now all the way up in Mexico. The town of Medellin and even the suburbs was cleaned up by the president Uribe, who recently left. The Wall Street Journal, I think 2 weeks ago, had a really wonderful write-up about all of his accomplishments. He was incredibly well loved, and you could really see it in, you know, everyone just loved the man. And, you know, even in the lower income areas, a lot of pictures I didn't include here, you know, I'm sure that, you know, they do have crime, but it's not nearly as bad as, say, the lower income areas in, say, New York. And in fact, I felt safer in some of the lower income areas in Medellin than I do in some of the areas here in terms of, you know, the crime was just, at least not that I saw, but people just acted very, you know, it was just a very different culture there. And a lot of that had to do with, you know, what the president did. So he spent a lot in infrastructure. One thing that someone showed me was, it's hard to, you know, I didn't include here any topographical pictures, but maybe I can show something in here. In the town of Medellin, it's really, the entire city is built in a valley. And you're really surrounded by mountains all over the side. And sometimes you'll have a community where the richer areas are like closer to the bottom, and then they gradually build up. And in one of the poorer areas, the president put in a cable car system, you know, by the transit so that the people who live further up, you'll have a little bit easier access, you know, to get to where they need to go, and like little things like that that really help the quality of life, even in the lower income areas. So infrastructure projects like that is really fine. So I drink the water without an issue. Anything else? All right. Well, thank you all very much for this presentation. You know, hope you all found it interesting, fascinating. I know I certainly did. We have some of the brochures here to see like what they're putting together and exactly what they're trying to raise money for, and a sense of how much, you know, things cost. You know what? Let me just, you know, pull it out here. Yeah, I obviously can't pull it up on the screen here. According to the main things that they want to build in order here are, one, the first thing is a mikveh. And they say here the project is covered in $50,000 for its total construction and its maintenance of its first year. No, needless to mention that we have space for that purpose. Okay, they have to work on the English slightly. But yes, you can imagine based on, you know, what we just saw, that the first thing that they want to have is a mikveh. Second, an acquisition of a building of its own, which you could imagine for a small Jewish community that, you know, really wants to have most of its stuff, you know, together, you're going to really desperately need a central location. Something that we definitely take for granted, not only in New York, but certainly in the Lower East Side, where we've got a dozens of places to dive in. You know, here, this is their entire community center, you know, Jewish community center too. So they want to build one thing up there. They estimated cost here at $800,000. And the third thing they put here is a cemetery, where if not their own, like to build a brand new cemetery, but even to buy a certain area in an existing cemetery and corner that off, is something they would like to do. And they say it would cost about $200,000 in order to set that up. I don't know exactly what's involved, so I can't comment on the monetary things, but, you know, these are not cheap endeavors, and, you know, they don't have, you know, the money for it. That is a good point. Yes, they are, for the most part, you know, young, or at least have young. By young, I mean, let's say, 30s and 40s. were most of the people that I saw. They did have a couple of people, although for the most part, 30s and 40s, and, you know, enough that they have kids, or at least they're childbearing age, that they really want to build up, a school of some sort. That is an interesting point, that cemetery might have been, you know, elsewhere. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, maybe. But also, they could very well be thinking that, you know, first they want to focus on the Jewish life part, you know, and make sure that that's taken care of, that they can live as Jews before they work on, you know, how do you die as a Jew, which, you know, could very well... Well, exactly, but, like, it could very well be that that's, you know, that's the thinking that they have. Please, you know, can pass this around. Please take a look at these, and see how the community of Bejo, you know, wishes. And if anyone is planning a trip to Mary Jean Columbia, let me know. I can try to get you in touch with people, because it really is a, you know, wonderful place to visit, and some incredibly friendly people, certainly compared to New York. No offense to any native New Yorkers here. Thank you all very much for coming out. Yeah, one last question.
Would you like to make a follow-up visit in 2 or 3 years?
Would I like to make a follow-up visit? I would, just to see how things are doing. I'm not sure if I'll ever have, you know, the time or the ability to get down there again. What I would like to do first, honestly, is, you know, make whatever connections are possible to see how much help, you know, we can give them. Or at least how much, by we, I mean like the American community, either in terms of financial resources or the recognition such that, you know, I don't just come back and say, yeah, by the way, wasn't able to do anything. But I definitely would like to see them again and to see just how much they've been able to do. Or not just how much they've been able to do, but even how much they've been able to sustain, and to keep things going. And like if they find another rabbi that can actually help convert, you know, the bulk of the community there, you know, to see how it would actually be able to grow and better integrate. Right? Again, thank you all very much and have a wonderful evening.